Nyala Kadich Wajik Nyungamort and Karak Nija Wajik Buja. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to country, sky and waterways. We pay our respect to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today. Welcome to Nyungar Wellbeing. I'm your host, Brooke Collard. I'm a Ballardong Wajik Nyungar woman, and in this season of Nyungar Wellbeing, I'll be speaking to the next generation of leaders, young people of the Nyungar community, about a Nyungar perspective on self and community care.
My guest today is Ilona Maguire. She is a Bibbulmun Noongar and Koongorakan First Nations Australian artist. Her research and exploration of shared histories and emotive expression informs her writing, performance and visual works through her cultural lens. She is committed to creating space for celebration, yarning, healing and productivity for mob and allies through social practice, building community and exploring sources of empowerment.
Thank you for joining me. Yeah. So do you mind just telling us a bit about yourself, like your name for people who don't know you, like how would you describe yourself to the world?
Yeah, sure. Well, my name's Ilona Maguire. My Noongar name is Ilangan though, and I'm an artist slash arts worker.
So for those who don't know Noongar, do you mind explaining what Ilangan means?
Oh, Ilangan is one of my apical ancestors' names through my bloodline. I'm actually not sure of the meaning, but it was a name that was given to me by my dad.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. Like, I know for me, a lot of my apical ancestors as well, I didn't know their names till like I saw like it all printed out and I was like,
yeah,
oh, I need to find out what this means now, yeah. You know?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely sparked a lot of my curiosity because we have so many beautiful names and I think sometimes they don't come with a like quote unquote meaning, but they sound beautiful. So I'd love to, yeah, find maybe there's records somewhere, but that's all a part of the fun of my practice, I guess, thinking about like research and how important information is to inform my practice, however I take it.
When you're talking about your research for your art, really diving into history and things like that, do you think something like that is tied into, you know, you're named after someone who you haven't met, who's like your ancestor and you've got that connection through the name? Is that how you're finding connection through, like, to yourself through the past?
Yeah, definitely. I find that gives me a really strong identity. Like, I grew up knowing exactly who I am through my old people and the way that my parents and my grandparents would tell me stories about them and the way that they would live and the things that they would live by, like their values and our whole cosmology and all of that. So that part of my identity is so strong because having that strong link to those people, which I'm very fortunate and privileged to have.
I remember from a while ago, one of your art exhibitions just has stayed with me. Same as like Yabini as well, some words she's written. I quote it all the time.
Yeah.
And like, you made, it was like the old bed frames and you weaved on there and I'm a basket weaver myself as well.
Yeah.
And that one really stuck with me because I was like, oh, you're saying so much on there.
Yeah. Thank you. That was a really funny artwork. And I had this really love-hate relationship with it because it was so clunky and awkward and it was just a pain to transport as well. And it took so long to find that cyclone bed. And it was just such a kind of identifying icon of the outback identity. And that it was just made out of awful materials. So I thought, how am I going to like sort of literally weave into this to create this idea of like intersecting cultures and ideas around the way that we interact with each other in Australia and these kind of race relations. So literally having like this weaving cut through the cyclone bed and they created this kind of crossing intersection was really an interesting way for me to kind of try to awkwardly beautify this like really ugly thing that's so tied with Australian identity and what Australian identity really is, because it's very strange to me.
I didn't get the strange vibes from it, but like hearing you talk about it, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And for me, like I was like, oh, this is just like such a beautiful way of showing me. I immediately think of some of the beds that some of our people had to sleep on like the missions and everything.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're making something where you're showing, well, this is there, but like our culture's still going to come through no matter what's happened to us. So yeah, that one really stuck with me.
Yeah.
And talking about lugging annoying art pieces around. I did see, again, recently as well, because you work a lot with Cole Baxter as well.
Mm.
You had a couch that you'd done some artwork and you guys were trying to get people to take that home as
Yes. he's been trying to palm it off from his studio because he was like, oh, do you want it, sis? So I was like, nah, you keep it, brother. Like, keep it in the studio with you. And we were like, oh, maybe we'll chuck it up on Instagram and see if anybody wants to take it. I don't know if anybody's taken it yet. I need to ask him. But yeah, that was a massive couch that we'd kind of driven around for, like, for Vergeside Collection, because we just wanted a place for people to sit and read from the mini library and to watch his he had this kind of old TV where he was showing some of his photos from previous protests and rallies and things. So, yeah, creating like a little space. And then on the back, I think we wrote something like, take a load off, you're on stolen land. We're like, yeah, that's good. you just had to like, yeah, make it all, about activism and stuff, even the chair. So, yeah, that was a really fun thing. But again, clunky and awkward, which is sometimes really fun to grapple with clunky and awkward artworks. I find that materiality is really important, an important part of my process sometimes, even though I, you know, don't bet on it, but I just end up with the clunky and awkward artwork sometimes.
Like, you're obviously like a multidisciplinary artist. Like, there's so many different things you've done. You're not just like a visual artist. I would say you're a multidisciplinary artist. I've had that label on myself before as well, and I feel like it fits because it's just at the core of it, you're a storyteller, really, is what you want to be doing. And for yourself, you know, I've seen you do like not just like visual arts, but you do like amazing, huge scale drone light shows, for example. Do you mind telling us about like the process for that and how that came about?
Yeah, I just try to kind of maintain this like artist thing and then allow whatever I want within that to be explored. And yeah, drone shows have kind of come about from just that, I think, when back in 2019, I spoke with the Fremantle Biennale team and they were really excited about the prospect of Wajak artists being able to work in different ways and being a little free and flexible around the way that I was practicing at the time, because I was drawing and printmaking, which, you know, you wouldn't think translate into drone shows, but they'd kind of approached me and I said, yeah, like I'm open to working with drones for sure, because I mean, why not? And the premise of it being that we share stories of place and original place names and language and all these beautiful things that create really multidimensional works in our culturally informed way. I was really open to it and ended up developing this sort of blueprint around creating like cultural drone shows. And drone is such like a dirty word now, you know, it's like a very commercial landscape that it's sort of turned into, but with First Lights, we really try to maintain the cultural authenticity of the story as much as we can, whilst the drones are really just a medium to communicate that in really creative ways. And you can, you know, have a billion different colours and they move in these really interesting ways and can really complement and ground people in place in really huge outdoor areas. So, yeah, it's a really unique way of telling stories and something that I've been really invested in personally, but also just like on a cultural level, it's been incredible to meet and connect with so many people from different mobs.
It sounds like a massive level of work too, because you're kind of creating like that framework for how people can work culturally with drone. And I think it's so important what you're talking about with, you know, taking into consideration like where exactly the story is and making sure it's appropriate to be told to especially like a wide audience like that. And, you know, I got so much FOMO every time I couldn't be there. I was watching all the lives on Facebook. Like, it was amazing in that way for me, like someone who wasn't able to be on country, I could watch it somewhere else and still feel like involved and connected.
Yep.
And just hearing like the soundscapes and stuff and imagining that like there, because it was just like, you know, when something's real loud and the sound's like reverberating through your body and everything around you, it's quite like powerful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the whole sound system, like the sound really leads it. And I think a lot of people in film like yourself would understand like how important that sound aspect is in carrying people and the tone, the live aspect of it, that kind of one-off, really rare occurrence that if you happen to be in the area, then you can definitely come and see the show kind of thing is, that's really important to portraying the story as closely as possible in the way that we intended. So that's why it's so place responsive and specific.
I really loved earlier how, you know, you're describing like your artworks as like this strange like middle ground of where you're trying to connect something that's like so ugly that's seen as like the outdoor Australian culture with like where you relate to what your version of Australia is, and even the couch where you were saying like it's just about having like a laugh about it.
Yeah.
So I love that, you know, that energy that you're bringing into your artwork because, you know, how would you say you're bringing that in your own way? Because I know a lot of people say you got to laugh or you'll cry.
Yes.
So yes. Is that how you feel like you go into your artwork?
I feel really like I have an obligation to bring humor into the things that I do, whether that's just in my practice or the things that I actually put out there for people to experience. Humor is a really important aspect of it because, yes, very true. I say that all the time. If we didn't laugh, we'd cry. As Aboriginal people, as Torres Strait Islander people, I really try to find ways, and that's where a lot of my creative juice is spent, is trying to find ways how to communicate this in a way that people aren't going to shut off when they see it or hear it, and that they're actually open enough to, you know, be led through humour or be led through a gentle kind of way of introducing, and then you get them, and then you're able to, you know, just communicate. And, that's a really interesting part of making work in a kind of political way or just the things that we have to deal with and telling our stories. It's really important to consider that, I think, as an artist. Yeah. Do you find that like in your work?
Yeah. I mean, like obviously talking from like a film perspective as a producer and writer, for me, it's a very fine line where you're like, you're fighting between what you really want to say, which is coming from the pit of your guts where you just want to like scream sometimes, but then you're like, oh, but I need to say this in a way that people are actually going to take this on board and actually learn something afterwards.
Yeah.
It's all about just kind of navigating those areas and working out the best way to tell that story, because film is such like a big like business thing, especially being a producer and, you know, you're talking money and things like that all the time.
Yeah.
You've really got to like find that fine line of like, you know, who's your audience? And like for us, I feel like especially always we're like, well, it's for mobs straight away. So
totally.
Yeah, it's hard. It's definitely hard for me anyway, where I'm like, well, I know who I want to make this for, like my friends and my family, but you got to write it in a way to invite others in as well so that they don't feel excluded. So do you ever feel like that with your art practice?
Yes. Yeah. And just thinking about the fact that, it would be great if we could just make things for us mob, and like a lot of the time we can, but when it comes to like the big business side of things and navigating that, is that unfortunately we just don't have the masses. Like, of course, like in the statistics, we literally don't have the masses, as we could see from last year, for example. But then we have to kind of appeal to a larger audience, which aren't us. So that's always an interesting part of how we angle these stories and things. And, you know, a lot of people do want to hear a certain version of our stories, or a watered down or a more palatable version of our stories, and can get quite confused when it's not just authentically told, or they feel like they're left out or something of the storytelling. So, yeah, it's really interesting, and I don't ever have a quick answer for it, but it's always fun to kind of go into it with an open mind and knowing, like, you know, we just have to try our best to stay as authentic as possible whilst also, being able to communicate our message to people that probably need to hear it.
I'll have to read that because that makes me laugh too, because my partner, Gary Hamaguchi, so he's a writer and director for film. And he actually worked on, I don't know if you saw it, they did a Yagan episode on Stuff the British Stole. So he directed that episode.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And like,
got to see this.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. I'm not just saying that because he's my partner.
Yeah.
But, you know, like Mark Fennell, who's the host for that, he posted a picture on Instagram being like, guess where I'm going next? Literally everyone in the comments was like, oh, NT, like Alice Springs. And it's like, it was Noongar Dancers.
Oh, you know? Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It was in Perth, guys.
Like, wow.
Yeah, like just going back to that, like, you know, people thinking you got to be like in the centre of Australia for us to actually have any kind of art.
I know. Yeah. Or culture or language. Like, it's so funny.
Yeah. And that's actually something we did because we did the First Nations lullabies last year. Mm. So we did a Noongar version.
Awesome.
But that was a whole thing that we really fixated on. Is well, like, you don't have to go out bush to connect country.
Yes.
So we purposely filmed in people's houses, right in the middle of the city to show, like, if you just go down this little path here, there's all this stuff down here. And, you know, like, there's stuff like that all the time.
So where, good.
You know, even street signs that you're like, oh, like, there's something important here, but people don't know because there's, like, concrete buildings around, but it's all here. Yeah.
Definitely. Like, I was thinking about, Spring Street when you said that and
how that's what I was saying. Yeah, right.
And you know, people talk about like going out on country and I'm like, we're on country right now. even though it's in a city or in a building or a skyscraper even, there's still that heart and that spirit of country that's always there no matter what. And it doesn't make it any less valid than being out in the bush. Although I love being out in the bush.
So you were talking earlier about, you know, just seeing the statistics and especially just in response to the referendum for last year. So just speaking about that in particular, because I obviously have my own thoughts on how that all went down.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you feel like that impacted you personally?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was another one of these initiatives or campaigns around whatever you want to call them. That were kind of dangled in front of us like a carrot. And I think a lot of us, myself included, were just kind of like, oh, this thing's come up. Okay, let's hope. Let's hope this is something good for us. Although I think everyone had an inkling or some kind of intuitive thought that and gut feeling maybe that this was going to be dangerous or not. You know, less helpful, more harmful, or vice versa. But yeah, nonetheless, I held out hope for it. And I think on a more like, I'm probably going to get really deep with this, to be honest, because I'm a bit of an existentialist and I'm very spiritual. But I put so much of my faith into people and humanity. And after that result, I felt like that just dropped. And to be honest, I've lost my faith in people and the general public and, just the amount of no votes that we had. I went, yeah, I'm not surprised. Like when, you know, watching it on the TV, I just felt numb. And I think a lot of us did feel that way, just completely numb. And I didn't really know how to react. I think I like nervous laughed as well. Mm. And I was just going, it's the usual sort of thing. And, after that, I think I was in shock as well as many of us for months, and I think I still am a little bit, but I'm coming through on the other side with not putting my faith in people anymore and not in a depressing way. I don't feel like, oh, you know, everything is futile and this country is just a hot mess, which it is definitely, but I'm not depending on you know, Wadjalas or non-Indigenous people to understand where we're coming from. I actually want to lead with deep and radical love and put that and place that where it needs to be, and that's back in our communities. And to be honest, I had to find and put my faith in something because I think as humans we do that anyway. We actually have to put our faith somewhere, and I found faith in God, and that has actually realigned so much of my spirit and grounded me again that I felt so lost. And I thought like, oh, you know, this thing, I could see very clear paths, two paths for myself where I could either go down this really, really hateful, like bitter kind of spirit that I felt was manifesting and becoming a part of me and my personality, and my anger was feeding my anger. And like, don't get me wrong, I'm still angry, But it just looks different, and I channel it. I try to channel it in productive ways that will benefit our mob. And my anger doesn't have to make me a bad person, and it doesn't mean that I have to carry out anything with hate, because that's anger doesn't equal hate. Anger, I think, is a part of us that knows what we deserve. And if we channel it in the right way, we can actually achieve a lot of really great things and, you know, speak our minds and be able to articulate and communicate what we need. And I want to be a part of that. So, yeah, after that, I just felt really heavy into I need to get myself right now, because my whole spirit was out of whack, and I felt this really deeply burnt me along with so much of us that I thought, I'm not going to let this become a part of me. I'm not going to like let this stupid thing that we probably were never meant to get anyway, because I'm sure that there's something better for us. And maybe it was the shakeup that we needed. Like, maybe that's a controversial opinion, but maybe it was something that we needed to refocus our attention back into ourselves and realize that we need to like work on, you know, I think about like the analogy with like, you know, on the plane where you need the oxygen mask for emergencies, and you got to put it on yourself before you put it on other people. And I feel that at the moment I'm really trying to rebuild a foundation that is strong in spirit and culture and country, and realizing that I want to put all my efforts back into the community in whatever way I can. Yeah, that's been a huge direction shift for me, because I was making a lot of work that was like anger fueled and about colonialism and the story of how hurt we are, so that I can let people know. And now I look back and I go, yeah, I'm not sure if that ever made me feel better. I don't think that ever actually helped me. It might have helped others at times, and maybe it did make me feel empowered, but I think things that served me once might not serve me anymore after this. So I thought, nah, I'm going to reshift this now, and I'm going to lead with and really try to hone love and peace and kindness in my heart as a radical sort of contrast or pushing back onto the narrative that's being portrayed about us and for us. And that's that we're angry people, and that we're hurt and upset and sad, and we're full of grief, which I'm just going to push back on now. So, yeah, I really want to, I'm looking forward to this sort of phase in my practice, but also just in my own spiritual sort of practice, that I'm going to be able to lean into and portray more loving ways and leading with love and acting from a place of love.
Yeah, that's so beautiful and strong.
Thanks.
It's like flawed.
That was very long.
No, I love how you're talking about how you handled it personally, because I know for myself, like I was on a plane like a couple days after, and I was just wild as I was so angry. Oh. So, because you know, like the stats are like what, 2 in every 3 like Wodgalas voted no.
Far out.
So I was on the plane and I was looking around being like, it was you and it was you.
Yes.
You,
we were all doing that, weren't
yeah,
we?
Yeah. So it was definitely like a very like rage fueled place, because like, you know, it's like what you were saying, like it's the rug got pulled from under us because we were giving all this hope, and in the lead up to it, it looked like it's going to be a yes, which obviously it hasn't turned out to be that now. And I know for me, it's kind of a bit of a shift, and not a reality check, but a moment to take a step back and like just prioritize what I was actually working on.
Yeah.
So just to think about, you know, like what am I putting out into the world, and who am I collaborating with, and why, and like, are they coming in with the right intention? So I'm much more strict on that now, I'd say, like especially in film, because, you know, everyone wants to do like Blackfella stories because like we've got some incredible stuff. It's like, you know, on the same epic scale as Greek mythology and everything, and people are just catching on to it now.
Yeah.
It's about, like we were saying earlier, it's like realizing how important your voice is and making sure that you're like valued for that. So I know for me personally, like, you know, I was very much so like, I don't want to work with any Wodgalas. I'm going to make my own, not sovereignty, but I'm going to like go out there and do stuff for myself, because like I'm going to make sure that people can come up behind me and we don't need to have to like go through all these white institutions to be able to do what we want to do. But yeah, and I love just how beautiful it is that you're talking about, that you found, I guess, like solace and like God and faith as well, like not just like culture, because For myself, I grew up Jehovah's Witness.
So yeah.
That's very different, where I wasn't allowed to connect to culture because it's viewed as pagan with them.
Yes.
So for me, I'm not religious because of that. But I'd say I'm spiritual now because I've had experiences like just reconnecting to family and culture. For myself, because I grew up so strictly religious like that, like there was no room for culture and religion coinciding.
Mm.
So I find it really beautiful that you can do that. And I know there's a few more mob out there because there's like others who don't think they can coexist.
Mm.
How have you felt that's kind of like benefited you going forward, especially after a traumatic event like last year?
Oh my gosh, yeah, mass trauma. I feel that growing up and learning about my culture and the whole cosmology of at least Whadjuk country here, or Noongar country and Kungarakan through my mum's side, I have a really good understanding of how things work, and I also have a good understanding of scripture in Christianity, and I find that a lot of things make sense and align for me. And I'm always, you know, wanting guidance and wisdom and discernment to be able to decipher how those two come together, because it's really upsetting to me to, because I've done both the things. I went fully into my spirituality, Aboriginal spirituality, and kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater with Christianity, and just went, nah, like it's either one or the other kind of thing. And then did the same thing. And now I've kind of come to a happy medium where I've brought them together, because I feel that, I mean, when I think about the way that our old people were living and the way that we were taking care of the earth and living the way that I think it was intended, I can't think of anything better than that paradise of living and being so healthy in the way that we would live for so long and take care of each other and the environment, that I think, of course, like, you know, we had it so good. And then, of course, what happened, and colonialism reshaped, and especially just white Western colonialism came in, and with the missionaries, and were, you know, it was so devastating, of course. But I realized that that idea, like coming in and accusing us of being pagan or being of the occult or things like that, was so wrong. And that has been the cause of so much damage on either side of, to our mob, like that have had such a strong worldview from all of the spiritual practices that we have here and stuff. I just think that colonial mindset has destroyed so much, and not just in the way that we live, but our spiritual connection to place and what our real kind of role was here and still is, of course. But I try to find a way to not, again, like the idea of coming back to not putting my faith in people is really important, because that's where religion comes through, and religion can be really dangerous when people gather and start pointing the finger or acting and being in the place of God and acting like they're higher than or holier than thou. And that can be really dangerous. So I try to, try to engage with wisdom and discernment to avoid those things, because I won't be told by another person, especially a Wadjala or any kind of person, that, you know, I'm doing things wrong or that I'm my culture is not valid or important, or that it is something of, the occult or paganism. That's crazy. Like, it's ridiculous. And it's just coming into that elitist or that privileged position where, you know, white is right kind of thing.
spitting facts.
Yeah, whatever. We're here to do it. Like.
Yeah, well, you know, you're preaching to the choir.
Yeah, thank you.
I guess like going ahead, like, you know, because we've talked about multiple factors for yourself that do link into well-being for yourself, like not just your arts practice, but, you know, especially something like coming out of the referendum, how you did look after yourself, and like other people would relate to that as well.
Yeah.
I guess like what's something that you'd like to see in the future or encourage young people that's good ways for them to connect to well-being?
Yeah, good question. I'd say looking after yourself, obviously, in ways that suit you, whether that's through sport or, yeah, creating work or talking to your mob or hanging out with your friends kind of thing, obviously. But, I really am a huge advocate for, like, hard work and being able to create methods of working that allow you to just keep a pattern or create good habits for yourself, you know, whether that's like getting up in the morning and going for a run or drinking lots of water. But, like being able to create practices that suit you spiritually, culturally, if you have the access to that, of course. Just being patient with yourself and knowing that anger isn't a bad thing. And it's just the way that you channel it. And, you know, it's totally up to the people us as individuals, if we want to be a statistic or if we want to push back and know that we actually deserve so much more. And looking after ourselves is looking after each other. I'm a huge advocate for that. I don't know if that answers the question, but yeah.
No, it does so well, because like that's why, you know, we're talking to so many different people, is because it's not just like one glove fits everyone sort of thing. Going for my brain.
I got
up too early today to go for a walk.
Yeah. I'm like, I don't even know what to tell young people sometimes, but yeah, do what feels right, I guess.
Yeah.
Stay out of trouble. No.
Yeah, that's it. Because I know even for me when I was younger and like, you know, you get into those dark places sometimes, walking was the biggest thing. Like I just walk around and like, because I went to high school in Margaret River. So like, you know, just walking in the bush all the time, yes, down by the river. And even like this morning, like I get so like clingy for Noongar Puja.
Yeah.
Like being away. Like I love Broome. I really do. But sometimes I'm like, I need to get back down. And
yes.
Just walking this morning, seeing the Bangsha everywhere and feeling like, you know, Jeran's starting to come through. So it's all about, you know, just like you do with your art and your research, is like looking into it and seeing like what it actually means now with a proper like analytical lens.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people are doing that now, like Claire G. Coleman with Lies, Damn Lies, where she specifically went through all these like settler records and with a Noongar lens was like, to me, this actually means this.
Wow.
And like, you know, dissecting it all to lay it out to say like, this didn't actually mean this was happening, like they unlawfully did this thing.
Yes. Amazing. Yeah. We need more of that, kind of double-edged sort of, analyzing of the truth and history and being able to like, yeah, really draw from what the kind of status quo is now and Western view of what's happened or, you know, in a lot of cases what's not happened because there's not nearly enough acknowledgement about the truth. We try to do that like on my family tours. My parents run cultural tours around the city here called Go Cultural. And they, when we have people visiting from all over the world, we try to communicate and adapt the language into a way that they can understand in their worldview. So we'll say like, you know, there's hundreds of different languages just here, like in WA, for example, and we go, you know, you think about Europe, like you have a whole landmass, but they're divided by certain boundaries that they've each set and agree on, and they speak completely different, very distinct languages, but sometimes they can understand each other.
It's so apparent as soon as you draw those lines where you say, like, this makes so much sense. And even things where I've been reading this other book as well called Memory Code by Lynette Kelly. So she's not First Nations, but she references Australian First Nations people a lot because of our song lines and how she said that that's the peak way of the art of memory and like teaching people how to ingest a lot of information and retain it. So like we hit it. We had the most amazing method of doing that to like store knowledge.
Yes.
But the way to describe it to like a Western audience so they understand like the level it's at is saying it's like a memory palace.
Yeah.
And then straight away people are like, oh, okay, I get it now. So like you said, it's so walking the two worlds and like a lot of people call it like code switching.
Yes.
Sometimes.
Yeah, so, yeah, code switching. Totally. Yes. Yeah, no, we really did have it down pat, didn't we? And it's interesting trying to, yeah, navigate the world that we're living in now, post-colonialism, or, you know, during colonization, because that's where we're at right now, that, yeah, we're having to be able to maintain our authenticity whilst also manipulating things sometimes, or having to adapt, which is one of our biggest strengths, I think. And we'll do it again, even after this referendum result. I'm quite excited to see the way that people are starting to work, and like what you said, like really coming back into ourselves and refusing to work with certain people sometimes because we have to protect ourselves and our spirit and our mental health, and maintaining that sometimes can be awkward. And we shouldn't have to be apologizing for that anymore. So, yeah, maintaining your strength and tenacity behind your reasoning to protect yourself is our prerogative. It's our right now more than ever.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Nyungar Wellbeing with me, Brooke Collard, and my guest, Ilona Maguire. You can find more episodes at sbs.com.au/Nyungar Wellbeing or follow the series in podcast apps like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the SBS Radio app. 4 to 1.